Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. I am delighted to be joined by author and journalist Brandy Morin. She is the author of Our Voice of Fire, a memoir of a warrior rising. Brandy is also an award-winning Cree, Iroquois, French multimedia journalist from Treaty 6 territory in Alberta. Among her many awards over a decade of recording on Indigenous oppression in North America, she has won two National Native American Journalism Awards in 2022 for her work in Al Jazeera and English. I am so delighted to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Tanse, it's a pleasure to be here, Sylvia. Thank you.
Many people listen to the news and hope that the news will tell us stories that are really important. And, you know, we have had over 2 years of constant fear about pandemic. But in the midst of all this, many things are happening. You know, we have had war against the Wet'suwet'en people here in Turtle Island, in what we call British Columbia, unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en people. They're being under war, you know, in the midst of pandemic. In the midst of pandemic, we've had women disappear and murder. And I wonder, how have you, as a journalist, been reading this time, and what's important for us to know to pay attention right now?
When it comes to the stories that I cover as a journalist, which is regarding Indigenous human rights and human rights violations, it's the status quo in regards to the apathy and the indifference that, you know, mainstream society continues to perpetuate, which in turn perpetuates the continued violence, you know, that our people are experiencing. And I try in my work, you know, to push forward these stories as much as possible. And that's why I left, you know, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation when I was working there, the CBC and others, to branch out and become a freelancer, because I wanted these stories to get beyond the borders of so-called Canada and to the world, in the hopes that the world would really start to learn about the different atrocities that are happening here, because Canada really has this facade that it's a just and, you know, champion of human rights country, but that only applies, you know, if you are mostly a white, you know, settler Canadian citizen. It doesn't apply, you know, to Indigenous or BIPOC, you know, populations. And so, you know, our people are literally, you know, dealing with trauma after trauma. And our women and girls and even our men are living through, you know, a genocide against their lives. Our people are being murdered and being taken in the, what they call the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit genocide. And it just, it hasn't slowed down. And so when you say, how am I transversing that? I'm working hard to bring this, you know, out of the veil of this facade, of the veil of, you know, darkness. And you mentioned that I had, you know, won these Native American Journalism Association awards, and I also won one of the highest awards for journalism in the world this year, which is an Edward R. Murrow Award. That was specifically for covering missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And I went to New York City, and I accepted that proudly, and not for myself, but because of the need, the urgent need for, you know, these stories to be taken in, you know, by the world in order to help stop this genocide. And so, you know, we just keep pushing. And I think that we are making headway slowly. We had the graves of our children that were unveiled to the world you know, a year and a half ago, and the world acted shocked that this was going on here in this country. But I really think that that helped open the door more for an international audience to really, you know, see what's going on. And I think that the state and all of the different systems that, you know, are contributing, you know, to these inequality and this violence, this colonial-based system, I think that they are, you know, starting to, you know, feel that pressure.
You know, one of the interesting stories that we've covered is that of indigenous children who survive residential schools. And many people don't realize that the schools were open for 150 years, that the last one only closed in 1996, and that the countless numbers of people who have come forward about sexual assault, of abuse, of the children that die trying to escape the schools, and the trauma that that endures. Like, now we know that trauma affects not just you, but also your progeny, right? It affects your cells.
Yeah.
It changes who you are. And on top of that, we are asked to heal. But in order to heal, what we know is that you need safety. You need a space that feels safe. And Indigenous people have not had that. You know, it's legislation after legislation that displaces people, that, you know, denigrates their whole being, you know, whether it's by the kinds of stories that we hear cover. So when it comes to women, it seems particularly precarious because women lose their status, you know, as it has been such an easy thing to just lose your identity. Yesterday you were part of the community, now you're not because the government just suddenly declared that you no longer belong. Can you talk about how does this make not only the precarity of women, but also the susceptibility to them being exposed to violence and crimes such as the serial killer that's on the loose?
Let's take it back to when, you know, European settlers first, you know, came here to Turtle Island, and the Europeans operated in a, you know, patriarchal system. Many, if not most, of the indigenous tribal nations here operated via a matriarchal system, and their, you know, the decision making and the leadership of the different communities were equal between men and women. And when settlers came here, they imposed their you know, patriarchal ideologies onto the indigenous tribes and stripped, you know, that power from indigenous women and girls, because our people were heavily oppressed and herded onto concentration camps called reservations, and given rations of food, and then having their children, you know, stolen from them to attend these houses of horrors called residential schools. And if families tried to intervene, they were literally threatened with arrest and jailed. So oftentimes the police would go with these priests to get the children, you know, right from their homes. And everything that, you know, this snowball effect of, you know, all of this oppression that was put upon our people is reverberating to today, because we had, after the residential school system, we had the what they call the 60s coup, was taking their children, you know, away again from the families and placing them into foster care, into non-Native homes. And a lot of the times, you know, they were being taken away because the families were, you know, completely torn apart from, you know, experiencing these abuses of the residential school system and this intergenerational trauma, you know, that you're talking about. And, you know, trying to recuperate from that and not having the resources or the tools to heal, instead of providing and offering that, the children were taken. And then we have the continued violence, right, from the police that started way back then, that continue to target our people. And interestingly, or actually ironically, the majority of women that are in the prison systems in this country are Indigenous women. And in fact, Indigenous women make up more of the population in the prison system than Indigenous men. And so, you know, when that power was taken away, and these new systems, you know, came into place, those systems were designed to exploit from the beginning, to exploit and extract, from the stealing of the lands and the resources to the stealing and the raping, you know, of our women and our children. And all of this is very much connected to what is going on today, because you had the continual degradation and the disposability of our women that is so systemic, you know, in all of the systems and all of the mindsets of this country, that, you know, this has contributed to this genocide that has been going on for years. And that, you know, the numbers are not, like, you know, slowing down. It's absolutely insane. And so you have to understand, you know, from a broader context, how it's all of these different things are connected, but our women are stepping back in to their power and their place, returning to those matriarchal systems of leadership and community. And we're starting to see that, which brings me, you know, hope for the situation that we're in.
You know, there is so much lost in the language. And when we think of language, I often think about worlds, you know. In so many ways, learning English was a way into a world I could have known otherwise. And it's the same for, you know, English is not my first language, it's actually my third language. And but I think about the way that many Indigenous cultures' languages are very rich in verbs, you know. It's a world that's alive, and there's a certain aliveness within the language. And when you take children away for the sole purpose of dispossessing them of their culture, their language, their ways of seeing, their ways of knowing themselves, what that is a genocide, you know. And we've been very shy in Canada to say, oh, it's a genocide. Oh, it's not. We say, well, it's maybe a cultural genocide. It's genocide, you know. Yeah. And so to speak of genocide is not very polite at the dinner table, perhaps, but it's so necessary. Because until we realize that we live in a death culture, you know, one that is extractivist, that's constantly pillaging and killing the earth, we now know that there's like literally 8 inches of soil, topsoil, that nourish, that nurture every life, right? That's the food. And once you start making death zones by putting so many chemicals, you know, we're literally killing the land. We're literally killing ourselves in the process. So I wonder if you could maybe talk about what it means for us to not only reclaim ourselves, as you say, as, you know, to see the warrior in rising, to see ourselves rise up out of the ashes, literally, but literally creating life in our path.
Yes. You know, as women, as Isku, which is, you know, a woman in the Cree language, we have the ability to give life. We are life givers, and we are sacred in that, and always have been. Every woman in this world is sacred. Every woman in this world is under threat, and some, you know, more than others. And there are revolutions that we see, you know, happening at various stages. And, you know, one of the ones that the world has recently been watching is the one in Iran, where the women there are, you know, rising up against oppression, rising up against death, rising up to stand for life. And when I am out there covering these different stories, you know, for land defense and protecting the earth and the water systems that nourish, you know, all of the different beings, you know, on this earth. It is the women that are on the front line everywhere that I go. And I just think that it's a natural instinct because, you know, we view the earth as a life giver, as our mother. And because we are mothers, we inherently stand to protect her and to protect our children and all of our future generations. Unfortunately, coinciding with everything that is happening to our Mother Earth, that same violence is happening to our women. However, our women are so strong and so powerful that that cannot stop the death, the violence, all of the inequity, all of the oppression, all of the uncertainty. Through all of that, our women are still rising. Our women are still fighting. And they're not fighting, you know, with weapons of traditional warfare, such as guns and bombs and violence. Our women are fighting with their voices and their love, and they're literally putting their bodies on the line.
One of the most beautiful images that always inspires me is there was a protest against fracking in Mi'kmaq territory, and there is this woman with one single feather, and she just, you know, stands in front of the tanks. And I feel the energy return to realize that we are all connected, you know. Colonization has been fracturing life for so long, for 500 years, 540 years, if you really want to be literal. But I also know that life didn't start there. You know, we were thriving before then, and we will thrive again. The, you know, indigenous people all over the world have had prophecies about, you know, the end of this time, right? And many people thought when the Mayan people were talking about the end of the world, it's like, it's ending. No, it meant the end of this cycle, you know? And so to realize that we move in cycles of life, nothing is ever static, nothing is ever, you know, nothing, even though it may seem like it's been going on for long, it cannot be permanent, you know?
And I believe that we are in that transition, because before a new life cycle begins, you have the birth, and the birth is pain. The birth is the struggle. And I think that we are in the stage of that, you know, that final push, and it's the hardest. But what is going to come out of that, I pray for and hope for, is the liberation, you know, of our people and the, you know, the reconnecting of humanity, like you said, that has been fractured by this beast of colonialism, you know, because I think that we are so separated all around the world, but when it comes down to it, we are all human beings. We have our cultures, we have our nations, and we have our languages. But we are all connected. And I think that that was a goal of colonialism, to create that disconnect and to divert away from a lot of those connections and what really matters. And what matters is our, you know, our connections, you know, to the life sources, you know, on this earth and, you know, different things like that. But I mean, it's excruciating at times. You know, I'm involved in this work on a continual basis, and I'm, you know, witness to the, you know, the constant impacts and tragedy that our people, you know, are experiencing, you know. But when we put it in the viewpoint of, you know, this new life cycle that our people, you know, have believed and prophesied about is on the horizon, it makes it a lot more easier to try, you know, to endure. And I just pray that all of humanity would come together in this, and that, you know, this control and the deception of, you know, all of this colonization would be completely shattered, and that we could come, you know, back into our own.
And as you said, the birthing also requires us to be in it, to be committed to the pushing, to be committed to birth the dream, right? The Aymara people said, if you want to see what you're dreaming about, look around. Why are you creating? And we are born into the dream, according to the Aymara people. And in many ways, you can see that a new dream is afoot. You know, you're seeing it everywhere. And no matter how much they try to silence the stories, indigenous people knew children had gone missing. We knew thousands of them were missing. We know they are. And the graves that have been found are just, you know, the tip of the iceberg, you know, but we know that there are so many children still out there who have been buried without a proper burial, without a proper ceremony. We know that there are mothers who wept and wonder what happened to their babies till the day they die, and that's unjust. And if that's unjust for my community, that's unjust for anyone, you know. And so I think, I feel in my heart that it means being willing to make ourselves uncomfortable, you know, in the process, because we can change the world by being safely tucked away in our cocoons at home and hoping that everything will change just because we wish it and we pray for it. Prayer is good. We do need to pray, and we need to be, you know, lean on faith instead of fear. And yet, we also need to be present. We also need to show up. So as you have been modeling for us and presencing for us the importance of not only noticing, but speaking about it and sharing with others the stories that affect us, right? The story of the missing women. You know, there's over 5,000 missing women. Where are they? You know, we have serial killers that go for decades, you know, and even though the police knew about it, victims were not arrested for over a decade. They were murdering people and nothing happened. And now, you know, we have another serial killer in Winnipeg. And, you know, where the idea that I want you to talk about the response the city had for why they released it, they stopped searching.
So they, the police, the Winnipeg police, told the families of the two women that they believed were in one of the landfills that they believed it was not feasible, that too much time had passed, and there were a number of different barriers, such as, you know, tons of different clay and different things mixed into the garbage, that they believed that they, you know, wouldn't be successful in, you know, finding their remains. But, you know, these families, and particularly the two daughters of Morgan Harris, who was 39, who was a victim of this serial killer, whom I will not give the honor of saying his name. They, you know, within days of learning that their mother was slaughtered, and the day after that the police told them that they would not search the landfill for her, they are 20 and 21 years old, and they went straight to Ottawa, and they went straight to Parliament Hill and demanded that the federal government step in to help to provide the resources and to pressure the Winnipeg police to find their mothers, to bring them home, and you know, to do whatever it takes. And, you know, their pleas, which are horrendous, that they had to do this in front of, you know, international media to plead for the, you know, the remains of their mother. You know, they created enough of an uproar for the feds to, you know, offer the support, and for the Winnipeg police to, in turn work with the city of Winnipeg to shut the landfill down temporarily while they consider what their options are. That doesn't mean that they're going to search, but you know, there's been experts that have said that it could be feasible. There are cadaver dogs. You know, by the way, these dogs are being used across the country in various communities to sniff out the remains of Indigenous children that died in residential schools. And, you know, some of them are decades and decades old, and they are trained to actually even, you know, sniff out the most minute, you know, smell of bones. And so these families and these girls are not taking no for an answer. And many have said, what kind of a message does this send to the world about the value of our women and to killers that, you know, are, you know, stalking our women, that they can just take them out and leave them in a landfill and nobody is going to search for them, you know? And so it does tell you a lot. And a lot of people wonder if they were white women, if they were wealthy people, would the police, you know, put in that effort and resources to search for them? So I think that there's just a lot of, symbolism and parallels between this horrific situation of these, you know, serial killers, and who knows how many more serial killers are out there. He just happened to be caught. But parallels between this, you know, what our women are facing and how our women are viewed as disposable and as trash.
And the structures, the conditions that make people vulnerable to this, the extreme poverty that Indigenous women are forced to live with, the, you know, that the inhumanity of that extreme poverty is really, I mean, there are resources with still no potable water today in the 21st century.
Yeah. And I mean, there is like so many factors stemming, like I said, from the moment that, you know, Europeans set foot in these territories, you know, that are still happening today, that, yes, put our women in these more vulnerable situations to be targeted. But there is also an evil, racist, rampant mindset that exists, you know, within this country about the value of our women. And so these people that carry out these violence against our women, this serial killer specifically targeted four Indigenous women. They weren't just random women that he took out on the street. He specifically thought that it was okay and that he had the right to take out the lives of four Native women within a 3-month period. And that tells you so much, you know, about the deeply, deeply systemic sickness that we have going on that needs to be uprooted, that needs to be talked about, and that action needs to be taken on, because people, you know, there are 231 calls for justice that were released in June of 2019 from the National Inquiry into this crisis that laid out the blueprint for how to go about stopping this genocide, and little to nothing has been done.
Thank you so much for being with us. How can people access your book? How can people learn more about your work?
Yeah, so my book is called Our Voice of Fire, A Memoir of a Warrior Rising, and they can get it at any bookstore. It's available on Amazon, and it's available on Audible. I actually narrate it myself, and I publish with various, you know, media organizations. They can follow my social media, Twitter at Songstress28 or Instagram at BeMournStories. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Sylvia. This has been a really powerful interview. So thank you for all the work that you do.
Take care. Thank you for listening to Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an independently produced syndicated radio program made available for free to campus and community radios, and also to the world at latinwavesmedia.com.